alcoholic, and I'd like to thank everyone for having me here today and for Billy asking me, and this is my second attempt to be here. I was supposed to be here a few months ago, and I had a death in my family, so. But, you know, it's kind of ironic, or not ironic, but, you know, the gift, one of the gifts that AA has given me is the ability to be part of my family, and I was reminded of that again today. I got to spend some time with my cousin. She lives in Hawaii now. I wish I lived in Hawaii. Look at all the pictures. It's just gorgeous there. But anyway, so I've been on the road traveling a lot today. So I was telling and I was like, we'll see how it goes. You know, I'm a little spacey. Don't even know how to get home. But anyway, I think I told you my sobriety is May 23rd, 2000. I do have a home group. It's a basic text big book study out in Ashland, which is where I now live. It's about 30 minutes north of Richmond. I have a sponsor, and I do sponsor women, and, you know, as I was talking about, you know, it's been a really, I was very resistant for a long time to being fully engaged in AA, to being in all three parts of the triangle that we learn about here, to being willing to do stuff like this when it was inconvenient for me, to show up, you know, the little thing you guys read, I had to be taught so much stuff when I came here. I was just so incredibly clueless. You know, it was all about me and what I needed and what I thought I deserved and what was convenient and what was easy and what would make me feel comfortable. And it was never about you or what you needed or what the brand new person needed that's walking in the door. It was about me. And I used to get up during meetings all the time. I'd go out and smoke cigarettes. I'd carry on conversations in the meeting. I was just so incredibly rude. And anyway, it's nice to be, it's nice to be changed today. And it's also nice to come to groups and learn that other people are trying to, you know, just be respectful of the newcomer that walks in the door. Because that's our purpose today, is to carry a clear message and to provide a place where they're comfortable. So I'll tell you guys a little bit like what it was like when I was before I came to AA and what it's like now, and then how I got here, which is in between part. And I grew up in Ashland. I didn't move real far away from home, as you can tell. I actually live right next door to my parents and my grandmother's house now, which is so ironic. Because it's a small town, and it was like half the size that it is now when I was growing up, and I didn't really like that, and I didn't really like the family that I was born into. I thought that I was constrained. I was an only child. My parents, it took them about 10 years to have me, so they were very protective, and I just felt like I was too something to be where I was. And I didn't really, I thought I was too good to be part of the church that I went to. I thought I was cooler than the kids that went to the youth group and did all that stuff. You know, the school that I went to was a small school. What I perceived as very cliquey. I don't know whether it was or wasn't. My perception's a little off. And, you know, I didn't, you know, I had a lot of friends, but it didn't really felt like I fit in anywhere. You know, I'd be in the kids, the classes, trying to be, you know, with the smart kids, and I just didn't really feel like I quite measured up there. I wasn't a cheerleader. I was, by my examination, I was way too tall. You know, I was too ugly. I was too fat. I didn't fit in with these people. And so I just really had a hard time figuring out where I fit in. I was pretty uncomfortable in my own skin from, you know, an early age. And I just kind of thought that's the way it was. I tried to be the jokester to kind of overcompensate for feeling uncomfortable. I thought if I told jokes and I was funny, then that's how I could fit in. And so I did that. I used to get in trouble all the time. I have trouble sitting still. Still do. So, you know, I had all this stuff like that going on before I ever drank. You know, my parents, you know, today I see them for who they are, which is just normal human beings who have good times and bad times, just like all of us. When I was a child, I really expected them to be perfect, to not disappoint me, to just, you know, and I manipulated. I would use, you know, parental, you know, of course they have disagreements. So I'd use that to manipulate, and I did a pretty good job of that. That was a skill I carried with me all the way through. I'm trying to unlearn that now. But anyway, so as a result of that, of them being human, what I did was when we went through things as a family, I tended to back away. I tended to turn inward and just separate myself from people. When I didn't feel like I fit in with you, or you were prettier than I was, or you were smarter than I was, then I tended to back up and separate myself from you and pull inward. And what that created was someone who ended up being depressed, isolated, and felt lonely. Even on the outside, I put on a really good face for you. I'd tell the jokes and, you know, run around and try to be funny and all that good stuff. But it didn't work very well. And I didn't drink until I was 17. I'm a late bloomer by many standards in AA. I'm like, gosh, you drank when you were 7. Well, I shouldn't say that. The first time I got drunk was when I was 17. Before that, we had taken little sips off the little carton of wine, you know, and the orange juice. But I never felt any effect from that. It was just more to be sneaky and have fun and pretend we were drunk. So anyway, I was at 17 and at my junior prom, and we had gone to the cool place, which was the after prom party at my friend's house that was had a pool. And I was finally hanging out with the kids that I wanted to be hanging out with, because I had identified who I wanted to become, and it was somebody who partied, because they seemed to like have a lot of fun and they just seemed cool, and I wanted to be cool. So, you know, I can still picture it. We're all sitting there on the little, like, rocking chair things next to the pool, and we're drinking these little foo-foo drinks with the little, the daiquiris, you know, strawberry daiquiris and all that good stuff. And, you know, and I remember standing up. I think I probably had to go to the bathroom. And I'm like, whoa, it just hit me, this feeling of intoxication, probably. And I was like, this is the best feeling in the world. And I thought that it was triggered by standing up, so I started dragging everyone out of their seats, saying they had to stand up, and, you know. And they didn't need to stand up. They were feeling just fine in their chair. But what happened for me that night was what I would consider a spiritual awakening. It's the same thing that I get in AA when I'm really involved in AA. That noise in my head that I'm not good enough. It wasn't going on. I was just having fun. I felt part of. I wasn't worried about having to be the funniest person there. I wasn't worried about having to be the prettiest or smartest girl. I wasn't worried that I was like 10 feet taller than everyone else. It was just okay. And I hooked up with a guy that night, as much as I hooked up at 17. You know, he kissed me. I thought that was very exciting. I thought it was like, oh, I finally arrived. Here I am off to the races of this new life that I'm going to lead. And it was very exciting for me. I tell this because I had one really, really close girlfriend growing up all through. We knew each other since we were 3. And the guy I kissed was her ex-boyfriend, who she was still in love with. And that's the type of, I was selfish before that, but booze just gave me a little more oomph to do what I wanted to do anyway. That just started, I was selfish, of course, before, but it just started a pattern of doing whatever I wanted to do. And I would use alcohol as an excuse for it. But really, it was what I wanted to do without the alcohol. It just gave me a little more whatever. So she was mad at me, but I thought I'd had the best night of my life. So I started drinking every chance I could get. I still lived in a small town in a strict house, so I would do a lot of... I still spent the night elsewhere. I had a really cool friend whose parents didn't care what we did, so I was always over at her house and hanging out. And I was a big puker from day one. I was the one who was dry heaving literally all night long into the next morning. And they were like, gosh, we were going to come in there and just like start slamming your head against the floor because you were keeping us all up. This was the party people that were trying to go to sleep, and I was making a racket in the bathroom. I spent many a night cuddling the Porcelain John. Sleeping on bathroom floors and doing all that good stuff. And, you know, never was that a deterrent that, you know, I drink too much or there's something wrong or, you know, the rest of my friends are getting drunk. But what's happening to me seems to just be a little more extreme. Or they may get drunk, but they're not getting drunk like I am all the time. And that's how I was. I was the one who was just always sick. I was always more or less insanely drunk. I didn't, you know, if I had social drinking, it was when I was, you know, tipping off the wine box when I was like 12 or something, or 14. I was, the way I look at it is I was alcoholic from day one. I was just looking for something that made sense. And when I drank, I just drank. I drank to escape, I drank to feel better, I drank because it was fun, and I couldn't control how much I drank. And I couldn't predict when I was going to drink again, or and what I mean by that is there were plenty of times where I was going to have one drink, or I was going to wait a while because tonight's not a good night to drink. And I couldn't predict how long a time that would be. And that got worse as time went on with my drinking. And I didn't know that was alcoholism for almost a year in AA. I thought alcoholism was you have to drink every day, you have to lose things, you have to be older. I was 22 when I came in. So, and all those are just my delusionary lies that I tell myself so I don't fit in with you guys. So anyway, I drank like that on the weekends. You know, it wasn't like sneaking booze into school. The closest thing that came was we used to sneak it into the football games, drink tequila, which was fun. And, but anyway, it was, you know, comparatively, it was pretty under control, I thought, you know. And I was hiding it pretty well from my parents. They didn't know I was drinking, and neither did the people that I needed to not know, you know, like my family's church that they went to, my grandparents had a church. I would keep my life in different little compartments. You saw this part of me, and you saw this part, and you saw this part. No one ever saw the full picture of me, ever. And I kept it that way on purpose. So I went to school. I graduated when I was 17 and went to tech. I'm not real smart or anything. I just graduated. I was early going into school. That's why I was so young going into tech. And I spent the next 3 years pursuing drinking at the rate and the level that I wanted to drink, you know. And I thought that that's what I wanted to do, and I thought that that's how I wanted to live. I had no clue that I had no control, and I had no clue what powerlessness was. You know, during those 3 years of being up there, you know, the Friday-Saturday parties would turn into the Thursday-Friday-Saturday, you know, the Wednesday. And then it was I would take Sundays off and maybe Tuesdays. Then it was, you know, drinking 40s before I take exams so that I can loosen up a little because I haven't been to class all semester, so I'm kind of nervous that I'm going to fail. So I need to relax. I also started to participate in or experiment with a whole bunch of other things. Drugs are a part of my story. I don't talk about them a whole lot, but it was really important for me because I thought when I came here I was a drug addict, or at least that's what I was told. And I know today that I'm not. I don't have the same type of reaction that drug addicts have to drugs. What I have is an allergy to alcohol, and I did a whole lot of drugs to either increase that feeling, keep it going longer, or just because I wanted to escape. And but I was really confused, and I was, you know, that's one of the things I'm very grateful for is the sponsor who took me through this first step, just very slowly and very clearly, page by page, and we got to talk about all that stuff because I came here very confused about what I was. So I'm doing all that stuff, you know, this and that, and, you know, just whatever I can get my hands on, really. And, you know, so that just doesn't mix very well with trying to get an education and be a responsible person and someone who had a slight history of depression beforehand. I mean, that all got really, really bad. And I started to go and see therapists, and I got to see a psychiatrist once, which was really nice. She told me I was an alcoholic. I lied to her about how much I drank, which is kind of funny because she still called me an alcoholic. And I was like, this lady's full of crap, and you know. I was like, I'm here because my boyfriend doesn't treat me right, and as a result of that, I'm depressed. Because I started to hang out with people who drank like I did, and I dated men who were just like me. If you weren't on the same path as me, then we really didn't have anything in common. Because the only thing that I could give you in a relationship was someone who could show up and drink and party hard and, you know, do a few other things. But that was about it. I mean, as far as intimacy and someone to talk to and be real with, I couldn't do any of that, you know? I had shut all that stuff off a long time ago. So, you know, so it was just kind of crazy. The blackouts were starting to come on strong. I don't know when I first had my blackout. It could have been in high school. But I started to notice them because people would, they didn't talk to me the next day, and I embarrassed them. And I mean, there's still things that I don't even know what I did, but people are still mad or were mad about back then. And I started to get embarrassed. So the way I handled that was I stopped hanging out with groups of people on like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I would hang out with you every once in a while because I didn't want you to see that this is how I was all the time. I started, for a couple reasons, but one of them was that I'd go out by myself and hook up with people out because I didn't want any, I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and if I wanted to go somewhere else or be with other people, I needed to be free to do that. That's what I thought. You know, the reality was that I didn't have any friends, you know. My friends were drinking buddies. My good friend from college had dropped out because the way we were living was too much for her. My other girlfriend that I was close with, she didn't party like I did, so I didn't really hang out with her that much. But I pretended that I did all these things, you know, to kind of protect myself. But what it was is I didn't get to really know anybody, and all I did was drink. So it was pretty lonely. It took me a long time in sobriety to realize that. I used to just think I was fine, but anyway, I wasn't. So, and my relationships with men were pretty disgusting. You know, like I said before, it's like if you were like me, then I would hang out with you, you know, maybe a year. That was probably the longest relationship I had, and it wasn't really a relationship. Other than that, you know, we would hang out like 30 days, and then I'd move on to somebody else because you would get sick of me. And wouldn't want to be with me. I had plenty of people tell me, you know, your behavior is inexcusable. I never know what's going to happen to you. You know, you come home and, you know, you look like really bad. And the nicest way I can say that. And things were starting to happen to me that I didn't want to happen to me. I was going over to people's houses looking for things and got more than I bargained for. Waking up the next morning in lots of different places that I didn't know how I got there. I didn't know who I was with, or if I knew them, I didn't know why I was there with them. It's kind of like all a surprise in the morning. You know, I tried to work a little, but I really wasn't that employable. And so I eventually just dropped out of school before I failed out and decided to live up in Blacksburg. I love the area. I would tell you that I was like this avid lover of nature and hiker and all this stuff. I mean, and that's true today, but it wasn't true back then because I wasn't sober enough to do anything. I mean, when I look back, what I did was I went to work to the best of my ability, and then I started drinking at like 3 because I worked the early shift at a restaurant. And that's what I did every single day. And I started getting myself into places that I didn't know how to get out of. And you know, the drug use had increased to a point where I was confused what I was doing now. And I was just really lost. And so I had this epiphany. I was drunk one night in a bar that I was going to move home with Mom and Dad and just get it together. You know, I was going to shape up. I was going to start taking responsibility. I was going to lead a life that makes sense to me. And I couldn't, you know, I wasn't saying all those words back then. But that's what I was feeling. Like, I'm going to get it together. You know, it's going to be different there. Because they have some rules there. And coming home at 5 a.m. drunk isn't one of them. So I went back and I lived there for about 2 months. I really couldn't cut the mustard, so to speak. It's not that they kicked me out. I was really clear that I just couldn't do it. So I went and I lived on couches out of my car. Had a little dog. I dragged him along. Actually, he's a big dog. He's a lab. Hooked up with this guy and decided to go on the road to tour with the band Widespread Panic. This is another one of my great ideas I had. And, you know, I didn't know anything about widespread panic before I went on tour. I mean, I knew that they were like the Grateful Dead, and I'd listened to some CDs, but I wasn't like a panic head or anything. It was just another way to fit in. You know, I had this diverse musical background. And one of the reasons for that is because I would hook up with different groups of people trying to fit in, and I would, like, you know, hip-hop, you know, just kind of funk and jazz and alternative and, you know, all these things. I'd hang out with the little street kids and, you know, learn all this just different stuff. Because I just, like, I don't know where I fit in. And I was constantly trying to figure out who you liked so that I could become that person, especially if I valued your friendship at all in any way or if I wanted to be in a relationship with you. So it was just this, like, what mask do you want me to put on today? Who do you want me to be, you know? What new clothes do I got to get so I can go fit in and be with these people? I mean, it was just absolutely ridiculous. So Panic Head was my next outfit. And, you know, and I had been, you know, kind of hippie in it for to some extent, I don't know. But anyway. So we went on the road and hung out and, you know, tried to make some money, but that didn't really work out because, you know, I'd smoke all our cigarettes we were going to sell at shows and eat all the food we were supposed to sell. And, you know, it was, I don't really remember a whole lot of it, so I can't tell you it was the best of times. But it was, you know, it was good for where I was because by this time I couldn't work. I was unemployable, so didn't require you to work, which was nice. I didn't have any ties. I had, you know, no address, which was nice, so bills couldn't come my way. And I was free as I finally thought I needed to be okay with who I was. And that didn't work, you know. The guy I'm hanging out with, he didn't drink, which is kind of funny. But, you know, he did a bunch of other things, and he was living this type of lifestyle. I didn't even fit in there. So at my very last show, I'm desperate in the sense because I'm like, what am I going to do? I got no money. I got no place to go. I got no home. I'm going to go live with my parents again. You know, that didn't work out so well. You know, I thought maybe I'll go back to Blacksburg and I'll live and I'll wait tables again. And so I met the man of my dreams, I thought. I thought he was my soulmate. I thought he was just the most greatest thing since sliced bread. And I remember one night we were sitting in this car and we were smoking one of those funny cigarettes and he was telling me that he's, I don't know what I was blabbering about, but I'm sure I was, you know, confessing my sins and how I'm just in a funk and I don't know where my life is and yada, 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 yada. And he said, you know, what you need is, essentially what he says, you need a relationship with God. And I was like, that's interesting. What kind of God do you believe in? You know, because you're smoking funny cigarettes and living out of a van on the road. And I wasn't judging that, but I thought, that's kind of interesting, you know? You know, because I had been reading levitation books and books about trees having energy, and I was trying to get energy from the trees so I could feel better. I mean, I was just into all, you know, whatever. Anything besides quit living the way I'm living and go actually, you know, be of service somewhere. That wasn't appealing. So anyway, it was kind of intriguing. So I hooked up with him eventually a couple weeks later and went on the road with him. He had a little child who was 3 years old who I just fell in love with. He's just as cute as he could be. And I've always wanted to be a mom, so I thought, oh, this is great. You know, he's got a dog, I got a dog, he's got a van, my car's broken. You know, he believes in God. We can go live this happy life on a hippie commune and raise vegetables. And, you know, I had it all planned out. We'll just do drugs on the weekends so that we can be responsible parents. And we'll just drink heavily during the week. You know, I mean, that was what I was really telling myself. And so I had it all planned out. It didn't work out that way, unfortunately. Or fortunately, I should say. You know, I don't even know really what happened. But over the next 2 weeks, I proceeded to have a nervous breakdown or whatever you want to call it. You know, just something flipped inside of me. I was not eating, not sleeping. I would drink, of course, when it was available. I adapted their type of spirituality to fit my needs and kind of took that little notch over here and all wound in with a nervous breakdown. It was a disaster. And he was saying stuff like, if you don't get your act together, I'm going to leave you. And I just couldn't handle that. I was like, can't imagine you leaving, you know, where am I going to do then, you know? This is, I think I finally found my soulmate. What are you talking about? You're supposed to be with me, yada, yada, yada. So it was horrible. I'm sure everyone involved, they didn't want to have anything to do with me after I had been with them 2 weeks. And I ended up getting arrested in Pennsylvania with 2 felony charges, a felony breaking and entering, a felony trespassing. Because in my enlightened spiritual whatever, I thought I was supposed to be at this place, and it wasn't my place to be, so I got arrested. Imagine that. And I was just really messed up, and it was very evident to everyone except for me. You know, it's interesting because my dad has told me bits and pieces since I've been sober about that whole experience. And he said, you know, one of the things that they told us was that whoever arrested me or judge or somebody, he said, you know, I don't know why, but he told me that he took a special interest in your case. And that, you know, things were just really strange. And he was just, he did things that he normally wouldn't have done. And I don't know what those things were, but, you know, I'll give you an example of what I looked like. I had a 10-gauge nose hoop that hung out of my nose. I had a shaved head. I was probably like 20 pounds less than what I weigh right now. I had a black eye because the little child had hit me. Because he was angry, you know, his mom's not there and he's alone. And I said, you're angry, you can hit somebody. He said, I can hit me in the arm. So he hit me in the eye, you know. So I had a black eye, you know. When my parents bailed me out of this place, they said I was going to come out of a concentration camp. I was like, thanks. I liked my image. It was very, you know, antisocial. Because it was like, you know, if you'll talk to me past my exterior image, then I might like you and talk to you too. But otherwise, you know, stay away from me. I don't like you. I don't like people, you know. It was very anti, you know, society, government, everything. The people I hooked up with were very underground. The government considered them a cult. I didn't know any of that. But I did tap into the fact that they were very underground and that you could just disappear if you wanted to. And I liked that idea of becoming somebody else, of starting anew, of leaving, you know, what I had behind. But my parents didn't like that idea, I guess. So they bailed me out and took me to Tucker's for an evaluation. That's a treatment center. And I don't know if you guys are graduates of there, but it's a lovely facility.
Yes.
And, yeah, I think, I don't even know. I don't know how many times I was in there. I think 3, but it could have been just 2. But when they let me out the 3rd time or the 2nd time, whatever that was, they told me that, you know, if I came back again, they were going to have to give me my own special wing. I was not a good patient there. I was locked down on almost every single floor besides the padded wall thingy place. They almost threw me in there because I was complaining about juice or something for the evening. And I just said, go ahead, do whatever you're going to do. I don't care. I was just so, I just hated everyone. And I was also so confused because there had been no change. The nervous breakdown, the separation from reality, I'm like reading road signs because God's telling me where to go and license plates. And I got to figure out what you're saying because you're really speaking to me in code. And I mean, that type of stuff was going on with me. And so, you know, the 3rd time I left, they diagnosed me as a drug addict, an alcoholic, and bipolar 2 disorder. So, you know, I came to the doorsteps of AA just a little confused. And I didn't come for almost a year. And so, you know, and years later, in conversations with my dad about this lovely experience that they all went through with me, he told me, he said, you know, when they released you from there, they essentially told us that in 6 months you would either be dead, permanently institutionalized, or you'd be living on the street as a prostitute. That there was no hope that you were ever going to get better, that you were in complete delusion about reality and your life and didn't want any help. And, you know, what they talk about in the big book, you know, complete state of hopelessness, just no, you know, no touch with reality. I had that about my disease, and then I had this other little mental breakdown thing going on at the same time. So I was in pretty bad shape, but I had no clue. Thought everything was great, and I was going to hook back up with this guy, and we're going to go off on the road, and, you know, I was devastated to find that my dad told me he didn't want to have anything to do with me, and so I tried to rebuild the pieces of my life on my own power. I tried to I refused to go to the little outpatient treatment that they had because I said that I wasn't going to go to treatment with people that I used to date, because the first time I went in there, this guy's telling this like story about his girlfriend and just some stuff that he had done that wasn't so nice, and all I did was see me. And I don't know if that would have been the right place for me. But even if it would have been the right place, I was completely against going, and I was willing to go to prison not to go again, and that's what I told them. I refuse to go. You can't make me go. Take me wherever you got to take me. I'm not participating in any type of treatment program. So I don't know why, but they allowed me to go to one-on-one treatment with this guy out in Richmond. And, you know, I've been to lots of therapists before. I used to go, hi, therapists, you know. I always wondered if they knew that. You know, I just tried lots of different things to fix me before, so I really didn't think this was going to help much. But, you know, he had given my parents a lot of hope. And what he told them was essentially, if she's willing to believe in something bigger than herself, then there's hope that she can get better. And that's all they had, because up until that point, they thought I was going to be dead. And I didn't know any of this at the time. So my mom had to drive me to the therapist's office. I went 2 or 3 times a week. I was unemployable. I was depressed because, you know, I mean, the way I'm living is kind of depressing. You know, my only friend was my little dog. And I would just lay in bed. I would tell my parents I had a sinus headache every day almost. So I could lay in bed. And I was just so depressed. And I'd pray and I'd cry at night. God, please kill me. Please don't let me wake up. You know, I'm not going to get better. I don't know what's wrong, you know, all that stuff. I was just really hopeless. Not willing to take any action based on that hopelessness, but I was pretty hopeless. And so after going to therapy for a while, one of the greatest gifts that he gave me was he wouldn't tell me what I was. He said, I don't know whether you're bipolar 2, I don't know whether you're an alcoholic, and I don't know whether you're a drug addict. You go figure that out. And I was kind of like, oh, okay. And, he, you know, he said it a little kinder than that. But that's what I needed. My whole life, I've been being told what I was. So, you know, how I got to AA was because I would try for long periods of time to not drink, because he told me if I don't quit for a year doing drugs and drinking that I will never heal from this nervous breakdown. So I was like, okay, I can do that a year. Then I resume my normal life. So I tried, you know. Sometimes I'd last 2 weeks. Sometimes I'd last 3 months. I'd go out with the intention of having one glass of wine to socialize and be an adult with my friend. And, you know, before the waitress could even leave the table, I thought about that for a second. And I'm like, I'm probably going to want 2. So we'll just order a bottle and we'll share it. And that'll be good and I'll go home. You know, so I have my 2 glasses of wine. And then we're across the street to the bar, you know, drinking. And then it's 5 a.m. and I have put everything possible that I can get into my body. You know, I didn't realize that at the time, but that's the phenomenon of craving. I put alcohol into my body, and I have absolutely no clue what's going to happen. And I can't not drink. I can for a couple days or maybe even some months, but I don't know when I'm going to drink again. So that's the mental twist that I had, and I had no clue. And when I came to AA, I would have told you I never tried to quit drinking. You know, it didn't seem like a problem at all. You know, I could quit drinking just fine with no problem. You know, it took me years before, or at least a year, before I was willing to look at that stuff and go, oh, you know, yeah, at the end I could quit drinking, but I was depressed and laid in bed and wanted to kill myself as a result. You know, so it's like, you know, my life got worse when I quit drinking, not better. A non-alcoholic, a heavy drinker, given sufficient reason, like they talk about in the big book, to quit, their life gets better. I've seen that in the family that I married into, or I've heard. And this guy seems perfectly normal to me. He drinks Sprite and has a good time with everybody else. I'm a complete you-know-what when I don't have alcohol. It's not fair, and I hate all of you, and you can drink and I can't, you know, that type of thing. So I came to AA, with the intention of graduating in a year, and hung around. And, you know, what I did was I used to go to meetings, and I'd do what I talked about earlier. I'd get up and leave and smoke cigarettes. I wasn't here for any type of solution. I'd hang out with the boys, because that's all I knew how to do. So I'd socialize. It was like a social club for me. And I'd go to different meetings. I didn't like any consistency or, you know, people to really get to know me. I wasn't helping at all. And I got a temporary sponsor because I'm going to graduate, so I don't really need a long-term sponsor. I'll just get a temporary one. Only because you guys kept bothering me. When are you going to get a sponsor? Are you going to get a sponsor? When are you going to get a sponsor? And that type of repetition still kind of works with me today. If I'm annoyed enough, I will eventually maybe take some action to shut you up. So I did that. I got a sponsor just to shut you guys up, to leave me alone. And, you know, she was very nice and very kind. I didn't do anything really that she asked as far as, like, I didn't call on a regular basis or anything like that. And the first step I remember doing was the third step. I remember sitting and talking with her, but I don't remember us really doing one and two. And I, by this time, had identified enough that I thought maybe I have a drinking problem, but I'm not really an alcoholic because I didn't lose the house, didn't lose the marriage, didn't lose the car, didn't lose the job. I didn't drink every day, and I didn't get up in the middle of the night and drink. So I wasn't an alcoholic. But, I better watch it because I might turn into one or whatever. So, you know, I did three, and I did my best attempt at a fourth step and a fifth step, and I guess six and seven, I don't remember. Went out and started making amends. You know, it was really a great idea. And I didn't even believe I was really an alcoholic. I mean, I did all the steps based on a lie. That's why I think it is so important to find out who you are, you know. If I'm really an alcoholic, then this is the fellowship with me. If I'm really a codependent, then I can go over to Codependence Anonymous, because they also diagnose me with that. If I'm really an alcoholic and not a drug addict, a drug addict and not an alcoholic, then I can go to NA. If I'm really bipolar 2 disorder, then some medication and therapy will help me, and I don't have to come to these meetings. But what I was getting was a lot of mixed messages about what the real solution of Alcoholics Anonymous was, and who I was. So needless to say, what I was doing wasn't very beneficial. I had no spiritual awakening from doing the steps as I did them. My relationships with men were the same dry as I was drinking, and they were so incredibly painful that I was ready to shoot myself in the head. I was just gross. I didn't know how to show up and be anything to anybody. I couldn't be a daughter. I was a jerk to my parents all the time, and they were letting me stay there, and they had done a lot to help me get to where I was. So anyway, I'm miserable again. You know, I'm crying. AA doesn't work. You know, I'm going to all these meetings. And not that they aren't part of the solution, but I wasn't in the full solution of AA. And for me, I am an alcoholic, they talk about in the big book, and I can't not be in all three parts of AA. That's just me. And this is, what has worked for me. So I met a woman at a new meeting that I went to, and she invited me to a big book study with all women at her house, and I don't like women, so I was like, I don't know about that. But then, you know, at night I'm crying and I want to die, and there's this woman that's asking me to go to the big book study. You know, it's the dilemma. Do I live a spiritual life or die an alcoholic death? And that can be drinking or not drinking. I can die an alcoholic death. So I thought about that a little while, as I do with most things. And I eventually went, and it was really cool. I got to know some women. And the walls started to come down just a little bit, you know. And what I got to hear was a lot of women talk about their experience with the first step. They read from the title page. I had no clue. There's a circle and triangle. I had no clue. There were directions in the big book on how to get sober. It's like, oh, imagine that. So that was kind of interesting. And I was like, kind of like a little bit on fire with that. I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Maybe I really do belong here, and maybe there really is a solution for me, and I don't have to live like I'm living. And so at the end of the weekend, this woman on Sunday, I remember sitting out back smoking cigarettes, and she was like, so are you ready to do something about this? And I was like, you know, and she wasn't nagging me. She was just asking me a simple, straightforward question. Are you ready to do something about this? Like, what do you mean? She said, well, why don't you come over to my house at 12:30 on Sundays, and I'll start taking you through the book, and we'll figure out whether you, basically whether you belong here or not, you know, whether you really are an alcoholic. And I was like, every Sunday at 12:30, that's like a commitment, you know, I got to show up on time. She wasn't playing around, I could tell. She didn't play around. And, there was something in me, I think there was just a little bit more willingness than there was non-willingness. And so I started showing up, and, you know, I'm not talking to any women in the program, so the first, like, half hour, I would just dump all this garbage on her about, like, how my life looks, and I'm, you know, I don't know what to do, and yada, 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 and then we start going through the book. And I eventually asked her to be my sponsor, and, you know, I'm really grateful for that, because there were two guys I used to run around with a lot when I first came in. One of them was 19, and another one may have been 19, too, I don't know. One of them is dead. One of them is no longer sober. And then there's me. And it could have easily been the other way around. But I remember the one who died saying, I'm too young. I might be, I think I belong here, but I think I'll come back in a few years. And, you know, and I didn't get that at all. I was kind of like, it kind of sounds logical, you know. I mean, you know, I'm just completely delusional about the reality of this disease. It kills people. He was actually in the in another fellowship, but, you know, it's the same principle. This is a gift. I don't get a choice whether I want to stay here or not, you know. I get to choose whether maybe I want to take some action or not, but people die every day of this, and it is very serious, and I had no conception of that. And today I do. I'm grateful for that. And that, and I think that's the reason why, I'm sponsored the way I'm sponsored. That, you know, to show up early, to reach your hand out to the newcomer, to sit still in a meeting, to not talk during a meeting, to, you know, stay late, to call people that are new, to do those things. And I didn't want to do any of that stuff at first, because it was really inconvenient, and I don't like women, so, you know, I'm not going to talk to them. But that stuff has saved my butt, and I'm so grateful for that, because today it's turned into something completely different. I went to AA to take from you all, whatever you would give me. And today it is not about that at all. I come to AA to give. It is no longer about what I can get from you or what I can get from a meeting. Now, I need meetings to stay sober. There's no question about that. But it's not about me taking anymore. It's about me showing up and being of service, whether I want to be there or not, because many times I don't want to be there because of my own self, whatever. Selfishness, self-imposed crisis. I'm tired. I had a headache, you know. I've been blessed with a really busy life. I get to work. I have a job. They pay me. It's amazing. I show up. It's amazing. You know, and I joke because I feel like I'm an undercover adult, you know, because it's like, you know, if they really knew the truth, then, you know. But, you know, the truth today is I am an adult, and I do show up, and I do my job to the best of my ability. You know, I'm married, which is a miracle in and of itself that someone would want to step on this journey with me. He's not an AA. But I say that because I wasn't the type of girl you took home to meet your parents, ever. I think a couple of people did, but they made that mistake. But I couldn't show up and be present for a relationship. I had no clue outside of, you know, being very, very intimate and drinking. What was beyond that? No clue. And so today I get to grow and develop in that every day. Because any of you guys who are married or in a relationship, you know, they know. You know? And when you're a jerk, you know, it comes out on them. So I've made lots of amends to my husband. But also he's gotten to see a lot of change. One of my prayers that I pray is, God, teach me how to be the wife you want me to be. Teach me how to be the friend you want me to be. teach me how to be the daughter you want me to be. Help me to always be teachable, to learn. Because the minute that wall comes up and I'm no longer teachable, then I might as well be gone because I'm walking backwards. So, anyway, it's very cool. Being married, I love it. It's a whole new thing for me. We've been married. We just celebrated 4 years in May. And anyway, so it's pretty cool. We have a house that we've been renovating. for I don't know how long. Not longer than we've been married, probably 3 years or more. It's an old farmhouse my grandparents lived in. It's 1900s. It was like falling apart literally when we moved in. We did some renovation before we moved in, but now we're still renovating, and it's just a really neat, you know, nobody would ever ask me to move in their house before, you know, it was more like get out. And that house is right next door to my parents' house, you know, which I've been trying to run away from them since I was like 12 years old. That dog that I dragged around is like alive and happy, and you know, I think I tease him that he has some codependent issues because his mommy used to abandon him all the time, which I literally did. But you know, it's just a full life today. I'm blessed with a huge sponsorship family of women that know me inside and out. That know, you know, there's no more faces anymore. I'm the same person, or at least that is my goal, is to be the same person wherever I go. That you don't catch me being somebody else if you see me at work as opposed to an AA meeting, or at home as opposed to an AA meeting. And that's something I've been taught here, you know. I mean, this is a spiritual way of life for all areas of my life. I try not to steal from work anymore, you know. I mean, I haven't done that since I was drinking, but you know, that was something that I had to learn, that those pens and pencils are not mine, and I don't take them home and use them. And that may be common knowledge for everyone else, but I was kind of clueless about that. That I show up to be of service to my family, whether I want to be there or not. And since I'm married, I have two families now that I get to go do that in. It's just a lot. It's a lot of gifts. I was thinking about that today as I was. I have a relationship with my cousin today, and they didn't really have one like I wanted to have before because I wasn't able to be present. You know, some stuff. I want to share a couple things. I wanted to go through the steps and share a couple things, but I don't have time to do both. So I'll share a couple things that are going on with me right now, and then I'll go back. And if I have time, I'd like to share some of my experience with the steps because I'm completely changed because of them. I'm no longer the same woman I used to be. I'm not perfect. Anybody that knows me can tell you that. But one of the things that that I did over the last year was I started a new meeting out in Ashland. And prior to that, I had been part of a home group for 5 years. And, you know, I was a baby when I came to them. And I was very, very attached to what that looked like and how my life was supposed to look. And I wanted to be part of this. And this is where my family is. And I don't want to leave. And I had to write some inventory, as I often do when I have fixed ideas about how my life is supposed to look, and I'm getting kind of agitated and fearful and resentful. And when that stuff crops up on a regular basis for me, it's time for me to write. When it crops up during the day, as it often does, I do a 10th step, and hopefully it's removed. If it's not, then I write. So anyway, I'm writing. And one of the things that came out of that was maybe just a willingness to start a new meeting and to be taken someplace new. So I did all the background work, and I'm like, I'll have 5 jobs at the meeting and still keep my home group and have a job there, and, you know, I'll just keep it all balanced. And what happened was it can't be effective in two places, at least for me. The amount of time and energy it required to set up the new meeting was a lot. And I had a treasury job at my other home group, which is a big responsibility, and I just couldn't keep them both afloat. And I didn't realize this, hindsight's, you know, 50-50. But anyway, it was brought to my attention that, you know, just be open to where God's taking you. So I changed, and I got to learn, you know, oh my gosh, a ton of new lessons. Like, you know, my family is my family no matter where I am. I still go to that other meeting all the time. And that the fears I have aren't real most of the time. And that where God takes me is better than any place that I can plan for myself. I went from a home group of 50 to a home group of 3, which was different. And people don't do things the way I think that they should do them, which is different. Because I just came from a very strong home group. And so I had a lot to learn, you know, because I got ideas about how we're just doing stuff. And you people all need to come on board with me and wave the AA flag and we're going to save all of Ashland and, you know, these grand ideas. And, you know, gratefully that's changed. You know, I still show up and I do what I need to do. I still have like 5 jobs in the home group. It's not a big deal anymore. But people can have their own experience, and I don't need to be tailoring that to fit my plan. And we just celebrated our one-year anniversary. And it's been just really awesome. It's grown. I remember the first time we got a newcomer, I was pumped. Like, you know, I mean, what we're here for is really happening. You know, new people are coming, and we have lots of newcomers today. We had no literature meetings prior to that in Ashland, so our big book study and our tradition meeting the last Saturday of the month. And we only had two meetings in Ashland anyway, so so it's filling, you know, a need that was there. So that's just been a really cool experience for me. You know, the other thing that I've been going through a lot is the desire to have a child for the last 3 years. And not having that happen, and being disappointed and angry. And first what showed up is God's punishing me because of the life I used to live. Because, you know, I wasn't getting paid, but I looked like one. And, you know, my inability, you know, maybe it's this. Maybe I'm not going to be a good mom, you know, yada, yada, yada. And then angry because God gives people kids that aren't good parents, you know, because they're sick, like me, you know, or like I used to be, very sick. So I guess right into it on that, like the first year. And then I just wrote some recent inventory and got some more clarity about it. And some more peace about, that I'm okay where I'm at. And if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And if it's not, it's not. And I am coming to that. I'm not fully there yet by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, we were reading in our meeting the other day about the third step. And, you know, one of the pieces that came out to me in there was that my job here is to be of service where I need to be of service. It's not about me and my little plans and my ideas about how my life is supposed to look and how you're supposed to look and, you know, the picket fence and the, you know, and the kids and all that stuff. That may happen, but it's okay if it doesn't. What I'm supposed to do is show up and be of service now. And, you know, in writing that inventory and being willing to be taken to a different place, you know, I've got two new sponsees, you know, I've got plenty of service opportunities, I have a closer relationship with my husband, and a closer relationship with God. And, you know, that's what the steps have done for me, is bring me into a new and closer relationship with my higher power. And as a result of that, everything has changed. You know, it's not perfect. You know, like I said, you know, we're still painting and scraping and replacing boards in our house. It doesn't magically become all painted. You know, I don't magically have a child. You know, but it's good, you know. And look, you know, how far, you know, I complain about this and look at where I used to be. Yeah, nervous breakdown, prison. You know, I mean, God can transform anything, I think. And I got some friends who are going through some tough stuff now. You know, we sometimes based on selfish actions, we put ourselves in some tough situations. And some of the things we've been talking about are, you know, if I'm willing, God can bring me to this, through this, and this experience can be used to help someone else. Because that was one of the things that touched me so deeply. Before I came to AA, I didn't know anybody lived like I lived, drank like I drank, and thought like I thought. And when I came here, I didn't know that either for a long time because I wasn't open to it. And when I got a sponsor and started sitting down and talking to her, she shared her experience and hit me somewhere that no one had ever hit me before. You know, it was like a little crack and some sunlight came in. And the fourth and fifth step, you know, are a place where that crack really gets kind of shattered for me. I get to see a lot of truth about myself. And that was very uncomfortable for me. Because what I was doing and how I was living was not very pretty. But in 6 and 7, I get to show all that stuff to God and be willing for God to remove what's not useful. So that's been, you know, it was, I'll tell you this one thing and then I'll close because I'm going to run over time. But I came to this last inventory and I was like, I'm so afraid that God's not going to change me. That I'm going to be like this and I can't live like this. And she laughed, and I said, am I not trusting God, you know? And she laughed, and she said, she laughs a lot when I read my inventory, too. but it's all fine. I'm not as sensitive as I used to be. And she said, well, if you didn't trust God, then you wouldn't be doing this now, would you? And it was like, oh, yeah, I am. I'm trusting as much as I can right now. And in the beginning, that wasn't very much, but today it's a lot greater. And I think, you know, if we you know, continue to do what we're asked to do here and stay on the journey, then life just keeps getting better and better and better. And it doesn't necessarily have to look, you know, the picket fence or the outside stuff. That may happen, and that's great, but it's inside. It's an inside job. I'm okay with who I am today, and I've never had that before. So thanks for letting me share.